Accession number 19896, Reel 1.
General Woodford, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Kenya.
Which year was this?
In 1930.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Kenya?
Yes, I did, entirely. Apart from one very short visit when I was in my early, I must have been five or six, to England when my father was very ill. Otherwise, I spent the whole time up to the time I was 18 in Kenya.
Where did you go to school there?
Well, I went to two or three prep schools, or one of which was a Catholic one, but mainly to government prep schools, which included a place called Parklands, and mainly Nakuru, which was up country, and then to the Prince of Wales School, which at that time was a public school, a government school, but run on public school lines, usually with staff from English public schools.
So you spent the Second World War years in Kenya?
Yes, indeed, entirely.
What was it like in Kenya in the Second World War?
Well, it was really, I suppose, we had a very comfortable war, that's the right way of putting it. The only thing I can remember at all about it was we first of all started digging air raid shelters, and I remember we did that in our garden at the outbreak of the war, which of course were never used. I believe the only attempt by the Italians, it has really been the Italians, to mount any sort of air attack on us was one solitary Caproni, which was intercepted just over the border, the Italian-Somaliland border, and escorted by, I believe, a Gloucester Gladiator all the way down to near Eastleigh, which is where the RAF were, where it ran out of fuel and landed. I'm told that was the only episode worth the name of a sort of attempt at an air attack. So the rest of the war really was very comfortable. And apart from the masses of troops that came through Kenya, which they did, a great many of them, of course, vast numbers of South Africans, and notably Cape Coloured, battalions of Cape Coloured came through, and of course lots of other sorts coming, both going north to the desert and going east to the Burma campaign. We saw a lot of those, and a great many transit camps and the like. But it was a very interesting and comfortable time, I suppose.
What was your address in Kenya?
Address is not quite the right way of putting it. We always used the main post office. We lived at a place called Kabete, on the edge of what was the old St. Austin's Mission, which was, I believe, was the first coffee farm in Kenya. But it was I think it's the White Fathers rather than the White Brothers who founded it in the 1890s. And we lived on the edge of their estate, looking out at the Ngong Hills in a funny old colonial house, long since destroyed, of course.
Were there any consumer goods which were unavailable to you because of the war?
I can't remember any. Of course, one was pretty small. No, I think not. I think we were really very comfortably off for consumer goods. Certainly food and drink was no problem. And what I do remember is that as one grew into one's teens, Kenya was full of American cars rather than English ones or European ones for the obvious reasons. So by the time I was in one's late teens taking an interest in motor cars to the extent I ever did, which is not much, but I could recognize a Chevrolet or a Dodge, but I wasn't too good on anything else.
Did the Africans seem to be affected in any way by the war?
Well, again, as far as one could judge, yes, of course, because it brought them a great deal of business and prosperity. Large numbers of them joined the army, mainly the King's African Rifles, but also other East African Pioneer Corps and the like. And a good many of them, of course, went to Burma, including... My father didn't actually go to Burma. My father re-enlisted, having been a soldier in the First War, when war broke out, and he served in the KAR throughout the war.
Did the war affect the mentality of the Africans in any way, do you think?
I'm sure it must have done. In fact, it certainly did. It's the same old syndrome, you know, how you get to keep them back on the farm. Now that they've seen Paris, I mean, that's a slightly frivolous way of putting it, but there's no doubt that those who went off to foreign parts, I think notably probably the Burma campaign, which was pretty difficult, and went through places like India and the like, of course they had an experience which was they could never have otherwise had, and it certainly affected them.
Did you see any evidence of that yourself?
I can't say I did, although one was aware, I suppose, that just at the end of the war, when I was still at school, when I was, what, 15 when the war ended, sorry, you could see signs of it in a way, because there were a lot of ex-service Africans about, and they were easily recognisable, because they usually used to wear either sort of army greatcoats, or they would carry something that showed they'd been an askari. And I can remember, for example, meeting an old sergeant major of my father's from the 2nd, 4th KAR, and he was full of troubles, because, you know, he had troubles back on his own small plot, and jobs were scarce and that sort of thing. And furthermore, of course, they were used to having really quite good pay in relative terms, and suddenly to find they had no more pay if they couldn't get a proper job. So I think it certainly had that effect. How long? I don't think it lasted all that long, in the sense that, I don't know how much of this is hindsight, to be honest. I don't think I was aware of it at the time. But there must have been a period immediately post-war where there's quite a lot of unemployment, I think, among those of the returning servicemen who felt, I suspect, felt that they deserved some kind of special treatment. Whether they got it, I don't think they did, actually. I'm pretty sure they didn't. But then things settled down. But, of course, it wasn't very long after that that the beginnings of that extraordinary movement of the Mau Mau started. But that was after I'd left, although I was aware of it.
Could you see any signs of impending trouble in the way of Mau Mau whilst you were there?
No, I can't say I could. Occasionally one used to meet rather odd folk. I mean, I can remember very well in the late 40s. I mean, I left to go to Oxford in 48, and it must have been sometime in that year, I think. I remember going up country with a friend to an area called Thompson's Falls, which is in the heart of what eventually became a very difficult area during the Mau Mau time. And I can remember meeting some pretty strange Africans up there, in circumstances I needn't bore you with, but and thinking that, you know, they were a bit odd. I actually spoke quite good Kiswahili, as opposed to the kitchen variety, which I suppose in a way was an advantage. And I can remember one of these fellows actually paying me a compliment about my Swahili and saying that, you know, it was better than most Wazungus, the white were called. But he was a peculiar fellow, and he had a sort of little entourage with him. He ran a local grocery. And I remember reading years and years and years later, reading, because of course I had no personal experience of it, that this chap had been one of the leading lights in the Mau Mau and an oath giver, which was quite interesting. But no, I can't pretend that I thought there was anything particularly serious going to happen.
In what way was he so strange?
I think more because he was a very powerful personality, and because all the people around him, his, I suppose you would say they were his entourage in a sense, were terrified of him. And it was quite plain they were, and they treated him with the greatest sort of respect. It's just a little incident. I mean, and it may be that I'm making too much of it, because, I mean, he was something of a gangster too. I think he ran the local hoods, I suspect. But he was a well-known character.
He was a Kikuyu?
Yes, Kikuyu. Mm.
Was it the Kikuyu with whom you were most acquainted in Kenya?
No, not really. I mean, I suppose mostly one was, because, of course, we were in living in Kibeti. This was really part of where the Kikuyu were. But there were lots of others. And I suppose we knew Luo as well, and Wakamba and other tribes. But they were mainly Kikuyu, I suppose one has to say, yes.
How did you come to be in the army yourself, please?
Well, by chance, mainly. I mean, when I left Oxford, I wasn't entirely sure, nor did the management seem to be, that I was liable for national service, or where it should take place. And I said I was perfectly prepared to do national service. It took them a little time to get their act together, and eventually they called me up. So that's how it came about. And I went, as a national serviceman, to Korea, and where the war was still going on. And had I not done that, it's difficult to tell. Again, it's probably being a certain amount of hindsight, but I suspect that if I had gone to some rather pleasant national service skiing in Austria, as some of my contemporaries did, I doubt I would have stayed on. I think I would have gone for the colonial service, which I only had a sort of half idea I would ought to join. However, I went to the war, and I find that fascinating. And I flattered myself I would make quite a good soldier, and I stayed on, took a regular commission.
When was it that you were called up?
I was called up in early 52.
And where did you do the training?
Well, I did my original basic training. I did with the at the guards depot in Caterham, the old guards depot. That again was by chance. It's simply that my uncle, with whom was my sort of next of kin for in the United Kingdom, lived in Caterham. I think that's the only reason I was sent there. And I had an enormously enjoyable 6 or 7 weeks before they found me out, by which I mean that I was obviously an officer candidate. And so I was whipped out of there and sent off to what they called a potential leader's squad, which was down in Canterbury in the old cavalry barracks there. Again, it doesn't exist anymore. And from there I went to Eton Hall.
In what way did you find it so enjoyable?
The guards depot. Well, you may or may not know, it had a great reputation in those days, and for all I know, still has, of being very tough and all the rest of it. I didn't find it so at all. It may be because of one's colonial background and, you know, the sort of schools one was at. And I found it really relatively straightforward. What was very interesting was that I was the only one in my particular platoon of about 30 National Service recruits. I was the only one who came of a sort of middle-class background. All the rest, the great majority of them, were London, mostly Cockneys, but not all, but sort of greater London, with a few, I think we had a couple of Welshmen and a Brummie, but all the rest were pretty well Londoners. All 18-year-olds, or thereabouts, and reluctant draftees, I suppose you would call them, and they were absolutely hopeless at looking after themselves. This was in most cases the first time they'd been away from home. They couldn't look after their kit. They couldn't know how to keep themselves clean or look after their stuff. They weren't used to getting up very early, and they weren't all that good at any sort of physical exercise even. And I find that very interesting. They very quickly learned, but and I found the system actually was very good. I was very impressed by it. I know people laugh about the sergeant majors and all the stamping and shouting, but actually it was done very well, I thought. And they were certainly outstanding people, the NCOs who did it, and set extremely high standards, which I can remember. And I was rather sorry not to complete my basic training with them. But as I say, I was found out. It was quite a funny story of how I was found out, which I could bore you with if we had time.
Please. Yes, tell me.
Really? Oh, all right. there was a routine in the evenings at about 9 o'clock. You had to stand by your bed with your denim trousers and your braces. Your braces had to be sort of hanging down. And the sergeant in waiting, as he was known, would come round and he would deal with what you might call routine administration. This was straightforward. He'd also take the names of anybody who wanted to report sick if they weren't feeling too well. And I may say you had to be very sick indeed before you had dared to report sick. Anyway, the sergeant in waiting would come round and they'd check on all sorts of things. And on this particular occasion, I'd been there about 6 weeks or 6 or 7 weeks then, he came round to check on everybody's educational state. And he deliberately left me. I was actually in the first bed as you came in on the left. And he walked straight past me. And then he went all the way around the barrack room, asking all these chaps where they'd been to school, or one thing or another. The great majority had left school when they were 14. And he left me to last quite deliberately. The whole thing was done as a sort of performance. And he then stood in front of me and said, I see you were brought up in the colonies. It was a little bit like that funny film, if you ever saw it, which RSM Britain took part in. And I said, yes. And he said, and I see you were at a place called the Prince of Wales School. And I said, yes. Actually, I didn't say yes, because you weren't allowed to say yes in the Grenadiers. You just had to say, sir. They don't say yes in the Grenadiers. They still don't. And so I said, sir. And then he said, and was that a public school, was it? And I said, sir. And he said, and then I see you went to Wadham College, Oxford. I said, sir. And he said, and you read philosophy, politics, and economics. And I said, sir. And then there was a long pause, and he said, well, he said, you're no good to us. He said, you're going to have to go away and be an officer. And I'm sure it was done as a deliberate act. And sure enough, I was sent off to be an officer. Actually, I think they knew jolly well from before that, but I mean, I managed to fob them off for quite a long time. But after that, I was dispatched to be what they called a potential leader. And I said, I'm sorry about it, because I reckon the guards at that time, for all I know still, certainly had the best basic training in the army, certainly the National Service Army. I thought they were by far the best. Possibly the Royal Marines might have competed with them, but not no one else.
Had the army been what you'd expected it to be?
Yes, in lots of ways. I mean, we had a we had a corps at school. Not that that gave one very much military experience, but I mean, for example, one had handled weapons, apart from the fact that one tended to be used to handling weapons in Kenya anyway. As I haven't mentioned, but my father was a regular soldier, although he was invalided out at the end of the First War, having been very badly wounded in it. And one heard a little bit about it, not that he talked much about his military time. But anyway, it wasn't too unfamiliar to me. And the idea of being in an organization like that, again, wasn't too unfamiliar. I didn't find it difficult at all.
How did you come to be a Royal Fusilier?
Well, that, again, was fluky, really. When I was at Eton Hall, I thought, when the time came to select a regiment, I thought the thing to do would be to go somewhere where there was something interesting going on. And there was plenty interesting going on, of course, chiefly the Korean War. So I inquired as to who was there. And it was really on that account, because the Royal Fusiliers had just gone there, that I put my name down for them and was accepted.
What had been your father's regiment?
He was in the Dorsets, as was his actually, it's not right. I was going to say, as were his brothers, but they weren't. His brothers were both, his father was York and Lancaster, and both his brothers were York and Lancaster. Not both, sorry. Yes, two were young York and Lancaster. Sorry, I'm getting in a muddle. My father and his eldest brother were both Dorsets. His younger brother was York and Lancaster. One of his younger brothers still was York and Lancaster in the Second War, and his other brother was a gunner. Anyway, you can see it's a fairly military regime. My grandfather was a regular soldier and retired just after the Boer War.
Can you tell me, please, about going to Korea, getting the posting there?
Well, I'm not sure how much there is to say. I mean, my main memory of it is what a wonderful journey one had in an old troop ship. The greatest comfort as a National Service Second Lieutenant, as if you were on a luxury cruise to the Far East. I think it took 5 weeks, as I remember. And it was a wonderful trip.
And when you got there, what happened?
Well, we arrived, having gone through all the Mediterranean and through the Indian Ocean and called places like Colombo and Singapore and then in Hong Kong, we have finally got to Kure in Japan, which was a vast transit camp. And we went from there, as I recall, in the Dakota, one of some old DC-3s, were flown into Seoul. But the actual, of course, that was a very different story altogether. It became suddenly rather serious and earnest at that point. But the trip out was a sort of luxury cruise. Wonderful.
What job were you given with the battalion once you got there?
I went straight in as a platoon commander in a rifle company.
Do you remember which platoon and
yes,
company
I do.
That was?
Yes, it was D Company, and I had 12 platoon. And that was off the hook in Korea, where there'd been, it was a quite well-known feature over which there were a lot of battles.
Can you remember what kind of briefing, if any, you were given on arrival?
Yes, I suppose I can remember the essentials of it. I mean, when I arrived, of course, we went straight into a sort of headquarters hutchie. That was quite funny, I suppose, because as we arrived, the headquarters, the battalion headquarters bunker, I suppose you'd call it, was on the reverse slope of the hook. And as we arrived in an American Jeep, driven by a terrified American driver who took off as fast as he possibly could, our arrival coincided, as myself and one other, our arrival coincided with mortaring and shelling. So there were various big bangs going on off all around us. So we bolted into this hutchie as quickly as we could. And there, very calmly, a rather languid and elegant figure got to his feet, who was the adjutant, and sort of greeted us as if we were reporting on an ordinary day in sort of peacetime in England. How nice to see you, and would you like a mug of tea? What sort of journey did you have? That kind of conversation with all these warlike sounds going on outside. So that was quite funny. And then he told us what the form was, roughly. And then we went to our different companies.
What impression did the platoon make on you at first?
Well, enormous numbers of different ones. It's a long time ago, of course, but I think what one mainly remembers about the... I mean, I took them over in a position in trenches on a feature just on the west side of the Hook, the main feature. There's all one big feature in a way. And so one had to go around with the chap I was taking over from, who was being demobbed, the National Service Subaltern. One went around all the different positions, the section positions and the patrol positions, and the handover took about 3 days, I suppose, maybe a bit more than that, and included going out on patrol at night and so on. One had a very thorough handover from one's predecessor, which was very good, and the impression one had was how very professional they were, to the extent one was able to judge that. People did seem to know what they were doing. I also remember, and I'm not sure how much of this is hindsight, I remember being somewhat taken aback that at the standard of equipment, because all the weapons, for example, were the old number 4 rifle, you know, which had been in existence since, well, certainly the First War and before. Not that there was anything wrong with that as a rifle, but certainly it wasn't what you might call modern kit. One of the great boons was we did have the jungle green, both clothing and webbing. So that was a great boon, because that was far better. That was by far the best stuff that one had. But otherwise, it was all pretty old, antique stuff. The old 36 mils grenade, again, a very good grenade, but one saw very little modern equipment until one got to know the Americans a bit.
What kind of men did you have under you?
Well, again, a great variety. A lot of them were Londoners, but not all by any means. And I had a number of... I had one famously... what's the word I'm looking for? Insubordinate... Scouse, Liverpudlian, who was in continuous trouble out of the line, but was a very good soldier in the line. And so he was one of those great characters.
What kind of trouble would he get?
Well, he was just he'd drink too much and thump somebody, usually. But, I mean, he ought to have been at least a full corporal. I think he had been up and down once or twice, but he could never really behave himself when he was out of the line. In the line, he was superb.
In what way was he so good in the line?
Well, he was just very good at everything. He was a very good soldier. He looked after his kit. He was a very good man on patrol, very reliable. He was just a very good soldier. But he was, I suppose, a classic of the kind. I mean, there are lots of people like that and stories like that. It must be Legion, I expect. But when it came to peacetime or a non-operational scene, he would very quickly get himself... into trouble of one sort or another.
1 month is this when you joined the battalion?
Oh, I can't remember the month. Gosh. I was there for the last few months of the war, so we must have got there in early 53, and we left there, I suppose. I'm just trying to remember when we did leave. I think it was September, August, September 53, after the truce.
What kind of duties did the battalion have when you joined it?
Well, we were doing what all other infantry battalions were doing at the time, which really was we were in defensive positions of one sort or another. At the time I was there, we had about 3 or 4 that we went to from the Hook, at a place called 355, a big hill, which again had numerous battles over it, and to different features on this main line that there was against the North Koreans and Chinese, mainly Chinese. All along the Imjin Valley, the Imjin and Samchon Valleys. And our job really was to hold these positions and patrol from them, so it was that kind of war. Very much sort of platoon commanders, section commanders, and patrolling. The major movement of major units and so on had long since come to an end. The war had become static from fairly early on. Although there was a quite sizable operation still took place. I mean, my own battalion mounted a fairly sizable operation in late 52, which I wasn't there for, called Pimlico, which really was a company size plus, which I may say turned into a fairly serious setback. But that's another story.
Any particular incidents that happened to you that we can record?
Well, I suppose a good many. Like anybody else, one had one's adventures. I suppose I twice had to go out in the early hours of the morning in pitch black and the rain to rescue patrols that got lost and got stuck in minefields. And that's an activity I wouldn't recommend, because that makes you concentrate a bit. I had to do that twice. One or two patrol actions one had. I can remember one particular one is quite interesting, that because I can even remember the code word one used when I was out with a recce patrol, and we ran into really quite a large number of Chinese, and it looked it was certainly fairly scaring, but it looked pretty serious, and so I called for what was known as the DFSOS, which is, I'm sure, is a term that you know, but defensive fire, but SOS, defensive fire. And we had a series of code words. And it so happened these ones were all named after English racecourses. And I remember very well this particular one was called Sandown. And so I called up on my funny little radio, these ancient 88 sets they used to have, which they used to say you could send a message about 300 yards if there wasn't somebody standing in the way. But anyway, it seemed to work. But I remember calling up and just simply saying Sandown, and the words were hardly out of my mouth. Sorry, before this great stonk came down all round us. This was the famous New Zealand 16th Regiment, who were in the Korean War from start to finish, and who were notably good. But I say the reaction was so quick that we were really almost victims of our own side. And I and the corporal who was with me, it was a small recce patrol, were both sort of half buried by the earth thrown up and so on, which certainly made us concentrate a bit. Anyway, we got away with all that, and we finally got back to our positions and back to our little hutches in the early hours of the morning. And what I mainly remember about that is that when I got into my hutchie and was sort of having a tidy up, I had a very funny and amusing and also very good signaller come orderly. And he was cleaning up my kit a bit and bringing me a mug of tea. And he suddenly held up my rifle. I used to carry a sort of small cut-down version of a number 4 rifle, because it was easier to carry on patrol. And he held it up to me and said, did you see this? And I looked at it, and the stock was deeply scored with shrapnel marks all along the stock. And yet I hadn't got a scratch, so I was really very lucky. So one remembers an incident like that.
What happened to the Chinese in that storm?
Well, I've no idea, to be honest. I mean, but certainly the casualties were caused, because they were fairly close. But I don't recall any sort of wash-up after that and whether we discovered how many. No man's land in those days was, in any case, fairly full of the detritus of war. And it wasn't unusual. When you went out on the wire, particularly a place like the Hook, there was still the occasional body uncleaned up, and one of the more unattractive chores one had after any operation was to go and pick up the dead bodies and so on the wire, which of course you did at night and hoping not to be mortared while you did it. And that was a very unpleasant but very necessary duty that one had to do. I remember doing that.
Would there be many?
Oh, well, quite a lot. I mean, the first time I did it on the Hook, there were a hell of a lot. We had a very busy night, and this went on for about two or three nights of different platoons and so on from different companies coming up to do it. We used to wear field dressings across our faces and try and get these bodies, some of which, you know, by that time were some days old, and try and get them to some form of body bag and get them down the hill, down to the jeep head.
Who did you hand them over to?
Well, do you know, I can't remember. I suppose they went into, there must have been some system, but we used to sort of carry them down to the jeep head. And I suppose they were backloaded by whoever did these things, and I can't remember who they were.
Did the enemy ever launch any offensive whilst you were there?
Not any major one.